Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Ruby Boots in studio. She is a new, actually an old artist who's been on all over, Australian artist, roots, country, rock and roll. She had won, I think it was like the alt country Star of the Year in Australia for like 5 years running. And she's just signed with Bloodshot Records right here in Chicago, and she is relocated to Nashville, and she's going to be in studio playing songs from her new album. And I'm excited, too, because it's perfect for Valentine's Day, although they're all breakup songs. I'm not going to lie to you. But that's part of love, too, right? It's all I don't have to tell the resident philosopher. That's part of love, too, right?
It's having there. And losing lets you have more and lose more later.
Tonight we welcome back our resident philosopher Al Genie to the program. Al, of course, joins us once a month. He's the professor of business ethics at Loyola University Chicago's Quinlan School of Business. At first we thought we were going to do some love relationship topic because it is indeed Valentine's Day. But we did that last year.
Yeah.
And you can find that convo at WGNradio.com along with all the others with Al. Search Al Genie. Tonight we settled on a topic. We've been talking about doing this one for a while. Democracy. Our form of government and what makes it work and what are the challenges. It worked out because the author and Yale history professor Timothy Snyder just wrote a book on tyranny and its attack on democracy. Of course, that might be in response to what many critics have observed from the White House. But for our purposes, this book gives us the entry into exploring democracy through its threats. That's what we're going to do tonight. And we do want to talk about that. We're going to do it all night. Not all night, just for an hour. But we wanted to start talking about the Florida school shooting today and the continuing helplessness and politicizing that we see and what is one of the biggest issues of our time, safety. What can be done to prevent tragedies like today? What can we find? Can we find the answers in democracy itself? Professor Al Genie, good to see you, bud.
Good to see you. And, you know, this is a touching topic. I think 14 to 16 gun shootings have occurred in schools around the nation since the beginning of the year. Either a gun on campus or on the program, yeah. Or somebody actually shot.
I've seen that number in so many different forms today.
Yeah, and today I think is the anniversary of NIU.
Yep.
Where five students, I'm sorry, I call them children, forgive me, I've been teaching for so long, I don't think of them as children, they are young adults, were shot down, you know, without any rhyme or reason. And I do understand, I must tell you, the philosophy behind our founding fathers and the right to bear arms, because guns were part of the frontier life. And in 1776, 97% of America was rural and 3% was urban. And guns were allowed because they were necessary for survival. They were necessary to defend oneself against not just the government, but against everything. And also, because we had guns, we formed armies. These were not, everybody picked up their gun and marched off to war. Just as in the Civil War, most of the South were actually their own arms. And so this was part of a real tradition. But now 98% of America and only 2 to 3% of America is urban, and only 2 to 3% of America is rural.
Interesting.
And guns are now different. I think I want to stress this again and again and again and again. I remember that M16 that I could take apart blindfolded 50-some years ago, only shot 16 and fired in three-round clips, one, three, or a continuous fire, and this was innovation. Now an M16 is absolutely a toy in comparison to the velocity, to the power, and to the bullet capability. So that you got hit by an M16, I hit you in the armor, in the lower side, it may have blown out something there, but the bullet passed through, or the bullet lodged there. Now the bullet tumbles through the body, and a wound that would otherwise you could walk away from now kills you. And so in a very real sense, guns have changed. And I think from a philosophical view, we clearly cannot eradicate murder, mayhem, madness, jealousy, anger from the human condition. But I think we do need to curtail and reassess and look at the range of options we have available for the public. I thought when the Connecticut shooting happened, how long ago was that?
Yeah.
I thought when Obama was up there, and when people made fun of Obama, I thought, my God, how could you think somebody could fake that? When children that young were killed, it would change everything. But I think we have to ask ourselves, do we need a national plebiscite in regard to guns? I would take that risk. I think the NRA is a very powerful, very intelligent, and parts of which totally defensible, you know, a group. But I'm not sure the whole world, I mean, if we had a plebiscite, my plebiscite, I mean, from the Roman times, everybody voted on this, that we would say, let's have any arms. Now, let me be very clear on this. I think that, you know, I think we should be ashamed by the murder of so many innocent victims. And as a democracy, I think we should be doubly ashamed because can't we debate, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight, and create the middle ground between right. unlimited access and no access at all? I don't like either posture. There's got to be some middle ground.
And we're talking about that tonight. That's why we're talking about this particular issue today, because are there... Is democracy itself, is it the tool to take this on? Yeah. Is democracy, the form of our government, the actual tool for the people who are on social media right now saying, enough with your thoughts and prayers, we need action?
Yeah.
Is democracy the way
through
this?
I think it is, because don't forget what the NRA is doing is blocking things in Congress, and congressmen and senators have voting blocks and constituents to take care of, and they're really doing this. But I think as a nation, when we look at these killings, especially the killing of children, I think killing others demonstrates our anger and irrationality, but killing children demonstrates evil. And I can't believe as a nation we want to condone this. And I also can't believe as a nation we want to be disarmed. I think that there's a real argument to have a pistol in a house for protection or some version. But this notion that we could buy a gun that could take out a squad of men with, you know, one clip is wrong. This thing that happened in Las Vegas this summer, have we forgotten that? Have we forgotten the people that were just slaughtered while they were watching music? Half of them not even knowing what was going on until blood was splattering all over them because of the music so loud, so on and so forth. But again, killing children, even when they're killed by children, demonstrates a certain madness or unregularity in our lives that we have to address. And to say, you know, my mother used to say, don't ever mention sex, religion, money, or illness. Well, what else is there to talk about in the human condition? I wanted to ask my mother. And to say that we shouldn't discuss this is to be to be political ostriches. And I think we do have to discuss this. And I would argue for we do have a plebiscite, that we do vote on this after a serious debate.
I want to be, I think you are absolutely right. There needs to be a discussion. And I think more than any, there needs to be a respect and a decorum to hear from all sides.
Absolutely.
Because it's important for people to be able to be heard and respected, especially if you fall and onto the side of you are pro-gun and you want and you interpret the Second Amendment in a certain way. We want to be able to hear, but and democracy is a way to get that argument together,
and
to organize it.
There's all sorts of reasons to have guns. Hunting, although I'm not a hunter anymore after spending so much time in Africa. There's reasons for hunting. There's real reason for having a gun in regard to animals and, you know, farming and so on and so on. Wolves, for example, have to be maintained. There's a whole series of reasons. There's a series of reasons for having a personal gun in certain kinds of settings. Yes, 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 yes. But you just had somebody on talking about the gentleman who was shot yesterday. Yeah. Where'd this guy get a gun? Right. Of course, criminals always can get guns. And the real sadness is, I'm sure... And I, without going into details, I sort of explored this for 10 minutes after we emailed each other today. I think I could get a gun in within an hour and a half.
Wow.
And that's wrong.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, I don't want a gun and so on and so forth. And there's something wrong in that. There is something wrong in that. And these rules, and that's an illegal gun. And now I'm talking about these the legal
rules
setup
that, right,
the
rule right.
that allow you to go to these unlimited or undocumented fairs and to buy a gun openly in front of people is kind of scary. And I also don't understand why any hunter needs a magazine that carries 20 to 42 bullets.
Professor Al Jeany in studio tonight. We're talking democracy. We're going to have that conversation about tyranny and democracy and the threats and what we can learn about democracy from its threats. The professor of business ethics at Loyola University Chicago's Quinlan School of Business in studio with us, as he is every month here on The Download. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. In studio tonight, our download resident philosopher, Al Genie. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. Tonight, we're talking democracy. Our first segment is really about the school shooting today in Florida. And as 773 makes a good point about, and it's a great way for us to start our conversation that we had planned, was that forefathers knew the dangers of tyrannical government. And that's why they had the Second Amendment. That's why the right to bear arms. And that was a big reason why it all came together and why democracy is in place in the United States of America. And so let's talk about that.
Yeah, certainly Jefferson said later in his career after a certain point, I think when he was Secretary of State, that the tree of democracy has to be fed with the blood of patriots and tyrants every 20 years. He wasn't advocating war, and he didn't literally mean that we should go to war, but that every generation thinking in terms of 10 and 20 years as a generation, no one generation could speak forever for all other generations.
They have to be reminded.
So you have to remind us, you have to redo it and relook at it. But the option of violence was always there, and the reality was that violence was the only way. I found a fascinating quote by Nietzsche, not the funniest and my favorite philosopher, but he says, but those who would fly the flag and seek power have to abandon history and abandon the notion that truth and disarmament will be part, be the way to do it. But this comes to our book tonight. And I think,
what's the book?
Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century by Timothy Snyder. And it's a runaway bestseller. According to Jason Smith of the Book Table in Oak Park, 250,000 copies in 15 months.
Wow.
Now, my book, The Importance of Being Funny, has sold 17 books altogether in the last 8 months. But think about that. An academic book,
three
a
of
serious
them. Yeah.
Academic. Yeah, thanks very much. You were the guy.
Yeah,
you were the guy.
Yeah.
But an academic book that's really there. And what the book is, there are two unsaid theses in the book. This book is, yes, can be construed, and he says it is a direct response to Mr. Trump and some of his cavalier attitudes and his attacks on the media and his political tribalism and his adversarial style. But the real unsaid thesis is a play on Churchill. Democracy is by no means a perfect form of government, but considering all the other alternatives, it's the best we have available to us. But it must be protected, refreshed, and maintained for it to work. And so the other implied thesis is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, and that we always have to look at it. So I take this book, and it's 20 specific points, and we only want to talk about 12 of them because some of them are too specific.
Too specific,
It's really a defense of participatory democracy. What do we have to do, participatory democracy? You know, your son is young. But you're going to find out somewhere along the line, you're going to have this conversation with him, not about the birds and the bees, about getting a job and working hard. You know, I mean, showing up, putting time in.
Yeah,
so on and
absolutely.
So forth.
Right.
You have to work.
Yeah.
You know, I can't. I said to my son somewhere along the line when he failed out of college for the third time, every professor's dream. Right. I said, you know, Jason, if I die tomorrow, I can't give you the professorship. I'll give you, you get what's in the bank, and that won't last that long. You have to earn it yourself. And I think democracy, we pass it down from generation to generation, but each generation has to relook at it and reboot it. And I think this book is really about three major English thinkers. And the first is John Stuart Mill, believe it or not. I went to school with him, but we weren't really close in the 18th century, 19th century. He said the key activity of egalitarian society is to study and pursue the nature and the limits of power, which can be legitimately exercised by a society over individuals.
So essentially understanding what power is.
Yeah, understanding what it is and understanding that when you use it, it's not just this is not this Machiavellian thing. You can do anything you want with it. What are the limits and what's the range?
And that, and I'm not trying to make this at all about what's happening in our current political experience, but you see a lot of the pushback when we talk about the vigilance and people pushing back at some of the decisions made from the White House. It has to do with the fact that the check of power, saying, yes, you have this unlimited power, but you don't have the right to use it in that way.
You don't have the right to use it. And then the other two points really point up that this is participatory. Churchill said, the real test of a civilized nation is the ability to tolerate opposition, unpopular points of view, and dissent. In other words, free thinking, free speech, and the right to dissent are critical parts. And so we have a right to do that. In fact, one of the things that I really feel it's unfortunate that Mr. Trump even spoke to this in his union, the kneeling down for football. We're both football lovers and so on and so forth. Yeah. And yes, it was a distraction. But you know what? That's part of our right as a citizen. I disagree. They were very clear. We're not dishing the flag. We're not. Yeah. We're not, you know, we're not.
It wasn't about veterans. It's about
this is about protest. Yeah. And I think we've forgotten the right to protest.
I wonder, and I want to stay on this one real quick. Well, maybe we'll stay here and then we'll go to the break, but and we'll pick up on the third. But that's a fascinating thought because right now dissent in this country, whether it let's just talk about political dissent and people who are not with the status quo or want to push back on something, and that could be on the left or the right. We've seen it on both sides. There is we all know about the echo chamber, but there's less of even tolerance for the other side.
Yeah,
there's less. You see it with when Steve Bannon's going to come to the University of Chicago and they're going to protest. He can't even come talk.
And I want to defend the right of the University of Chicago and Steve Bannon to be there. Every fool has a right to speak, even if every fool is not right. And I do not agree with Steve Bannon, but I think democracy means you should. Not necessarily respectfully. What does that mean? Tea and crumpets.
I mean,
somehow, somehow have the right to have that dialogue. That's
but you
really
see that.
Critically
and
important.
I see it. I see it in the echo chambers of the left, and I also see it on the right.
Absolutely.
I mean, you saw it with Obama in this way of not really recognizing or respecting one side. You see with the
absolutely.
With the left, it's
liberals
saying, I'm not even listening.
Yeah. Liberals are just as guilty. And there was a wonderful, I found this wonderful, by the way, Churchill is the one who's saying, listen, I've got to convince because half of England in 1938, 39, were willing to say, well, you know, this Nazi is not that bad. You know, maybe it's going to be a nice guy. Let's see what happens here.
Let's just retire. Let's just surrender
just
and see
another,
what happens. Just,
see what happens and let's give in. He had to convince the aristocracy and the general public that it is better to die than to let this man come forward, to appease this man. And that's part of democracy. And maybe we'll do a show on great man theory and what Churchill was as a charismatic leader. This is incredible stuff for a democracy. And if I get a chance to throw in the third one, then we can talk about it. Orwell said, if liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear.
Nah. That's what we're talking about. The right to tell people what they don't want to hear.
That's right. Now,
and
it's how you say it.
It's how you say it, obviously, when we talk about decorum debate.
Right.
But that plays into the conversation that's happening around the school shooting today and, of course, what's happening in this country right now. Professor Al Jeaney, my resident download philosopher here on the program, who's the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago, joins us once a month. We'll take a quick break here. 312-981-7200 if you want to get in on the action. But right now we'll take a break and then we'll get the news with Rob Martier and we'll be back. So stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, the resident philosopher, the download's resident philosopher, Professor Al Jeaney. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. Tonight, he's with us as he is every month. Tonight we talk democracy. Been having a spirited conversation about what it means to have a strong democracy, but also what are the challenges and threats. You just laid out what we needed for the three, and we got to liberty right before the news, and then we kind of shortchanged it. So maybe bring that one back.
Well, this notion of liberty is that, as Orwell suggested that.
Yeah, Orwell suggested it.
Liberty means anything, if anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. And what we're talking about here is knowledge. And to one more Englishman, Francis Bacon, 16th century, knowledge is power. And if that's ever been true, we know that now with computerization, we know that now what's going on with
Russia. Is Orwell talking about the concept of telling leaders and authority what they don't want to hear?
The concept about basic facts. We're talking about, you know, false news, fake news. It's the fake news, it's not objective. It is biased or prejudicial. Mm-hmm. All these comedy shows are not fake news shows. They are real news shows that are making fake satirical comments about it, so on and so forth. But now Orwell's really talking about that totalitarianism comes in and stays in when you can control knowledge. And knowledge, once you control facts, whoever controls the present, he says, controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. So you begin to define what truth is.
Right.
Truthiness is not just a clever concept done by Stephen, you pronounce it for me?
Colbert.
Thank you very much. You made fun of me all the time, Stephen Colbert. Truthiness is truth as I understand it to be. He made it whimsical, but he was really putting it to Bill O'Reilly on it. And this is the actual key of what Orwell is talking about. The notion that it can't be truth and it has to be objective truth. There's this famous story about Senator Moynihan from Massachusetts years ago debating this topic with his nemesis on the Republican side. And finally the Republican said, well, you know, this is just a matter of differences here and that you're going to see it your way and I'm going to see it my way. He says, that's right. You have a right to your opinion. I have a right to my opinion. But you got to get the facts straight. And you don't have your facts straight before you make an opinion. And so that becomes this whole notion of fake news becomes scary. And what this leads to is the essential paradox of democracy.
Okay, so let's get to the essential paradoxes of
that
democracy.
The essential paradox of democracy is that a democracy can, in fact, through the ballot box, do what the bullet can do for you. That we can, in fact, elect our own demise. We can, in fact, that is, without reflection, without due consideration, without due debate, without due input, elect
this
the,
is where,
the wrong people, wrong policies.
I was going to say, this is where the democracy, there's two things I see where democracy can be subjectified, right?
Yeah.
One is going to be this case where an uninformed populace, or uninformed, doesn't matter, but the point being that we undo democracy by voting the wrong people in, by not having the correct knowledge base
to make the right decision.
The other one is manipulation.
Right.
And this concept that there are other ways that manipulate the and what we see a lot of times we see it with the Chicago politicians, we see it in Washington politicians, where they have found ways to subvert that.
Absolutely.
That they use voting blocks and
depends
little
what
things
you mean
to,
by the word is.
Right.
I mean, could you believe the man got away with that? It depends what you mean by the word is. Bill Clinton, semi-demagogue. But what we're really talking about is not just factoids, but the notion of what's truth. And Orwell talked about, you know, doublespeak, you know, so war is peace and peace is unacceptable and so on and so forth. When you begin to change things, if you want an example of the nudes, how about Polish death camps? That the Polish government has now made it illegal to use that phrase and to talk about the Poles as a people being responsible for anything the Germans did.
Yeah.
Certain individual Poles. What they're doing is changing the facts.
Well, that's altering the facts. I love that because I got yelled at on Facebook not too long ago because I had a Holocaust survivor in. And I said that the survivor was in a Polish concentration camp.
Yeah.
And the listener came at me, it was very respectful, but she pointed out that was not accurate because what it was a
Nazi camp located
in Poland. And they want to make the distinction because Poland was not responsible for it.
But what the government is doing right now is really trying to say that the Polish government had nothing to do with this. And of course there was.
But let's get back to our democracy. When we just mentioned the two things right there about voting, it is interesting because today we even talked about with the school shooting that happened in Florida, what are the tools available to us as a society to try and get at something that we sometimes feel that we are helpless to avoid? Meaning, how can we change the system so that we will not have this happen in our society? One of those tools is to go to the voting booth. That's what been talked about. But that also
But it's how you get to the voting booth. It's what you bring to the voting booth. And so when you look at this lovely little book, he's saying all these are little rules. 12 of the 20 are little rules of how to be an informed citizen. How to be a prepared citizen. You have to be prepared. Remember, Hitler did win an election in 1933.
Right.
And so did FDR. And he did win an election, but within a year, he became total dictator. And so fascism, which is really from the fascisti, from the word in Italian, that bundle, they were all together. We're all, you know, one person, one leader, ein Reich, ein Volk, ein Führer, one state, one people, one ruler. And so he then became the total dictator. But you have to remember, it's easy enough to have a democratic authoritarianism. That is, that people elect because of fear, ignorance, lack of participation, a lack of real knowledge, elect the wrong person openly. Yeah. And you really have a problem.
I wonder about it, too, because we're such a politicized nation at this point, where you will be nodding your head for two different presidents.
Right.
If you are on the left, you're listening to this right now and you're going, yep, that's what happened with Donald Trump.
Yep.
That's what's happened. If you're on the right, you're going, that sounds a lot like Barack Obama.
Right.
That sounds like, you know, I mean, it could go either way. And at a certain point, the question is that our democracy is one that is by percentage points. I mean, it's a 51-49 win one way or the other. And there's going to be one side, 49%, that is unhappy with the results. How do we, as a society, use our government to come together in a sense.
How do we create a government to do that? And I want to a little self-referential comments here. I'm teaching a leadership course right now, an advanced leadership course, 50 students right now. And believe me, if I was, and I'm doing it in a theoretical, what is power, and using the presidency and the American presidency as kind of the quintessential notion of
leadership
power,
position,
leadership,
yeah.
And how it really can't be done because of the new system, so on and so forth. And I'm going out of my way not to mention Mr. Trump. Because I don't want to prejudice them to the real theories behind that.
Yeah.
He's still, you know, and other, you could just sit there and sure. They would hate me for it, so on and so forth. So what I want to look at is the overriding issues that lead to a more stable democracy is, first of all, one of the things is for participatory government, do not blindly accept, obey in advance. Be prepared, be critical, be skeptical, not cynical always. Ask questions, examine issues, avoid simple conformity. You're not children. We've got an obligation. And when people don't do that, they abdicate that, and then they complain. I'm sorry. Did you not know? My wife just chided me recently. There was a big thing in the village, and I didn't read it at all. And, I said, well, what happened there? And he said, well, it was on your desk. You know, it's your fault.
Yeah.
And so there's something to be had there. And he's really talking about that overreaching issue in democracy is we are not self-sustained, and we don't know our facts, and we don't know our issues, and we don't debate, and we don't debate civilly. This is really important. You can be angry, you could be hostile, you could debate, but as soon as we start to yell, rationality is out the door. Then we're simply yelling. And I think it's so difficult to do that. And I find it really ironic that the Parliament of England, they yell and scream at each other. But then there's also time when there's quiet and you get to say.
Yeah.
But I think that what's missing here is an informed electorate is just as vital as a prepared leader. But the informed electorate has to be informed and stay informed.
It to me is just fascinating when I think about the issues, especially when you talk about foreign agents that possibly would be messing with elections, which
yeah.
essentially means messing with democracy. You get this concept that, yeah, if you can uninform, I know that's not the
right
verb for this, but if you can uninform an electorate or misinform an electorate, and that's essentially what fake news or what's happening with social media accounts, and
right.
if you can essentially hijack the informed part of the electorate, you can
that's right.
hijack democracy.
That's right. Margaret Atwood, when she was in Chicago this fall, had the great privilege and honor of sitting next to her for a second when the photos were being taken, so on and so forth. She said, bottom line, words, they equal power. So be careful of the words you use. Language matters. Don't just shake your head. Don't just look away. Pay attention. Look what that symbol means. Understand what that really means. And play with it. The media and words in the Post film, the Post, which I thought.
Did you like it?
Well, I liked the message, but I lived through that era. And certainly, I remember sitting there for days and days and days then watching, you know, Watergate. I thought it, at best, was a television one-hour film with
really?
Two great stars in it. But here's two quotes that have really moved me. That the Daily News, the newspaper, is really the first draft of history. And so what's in that paper is really important.
But
secondly, when they went to Ellsberg, when the Supreme Court defended the right to publish the Ellsberg papers, that the Supreme Court said the press's real job was to serve the governed and not the governors.
Let me play devil's advocate
yes.
for just a moment. I don't believe this because I come from a background, I have a journalism degree, everything in between. But there is a movement in this country that the people who are writing the news, as you just said, the first draft of history, are biased.
Yeah.
That it's not fake news in the sense that they're making up facts or trying to trick you, they're a foreign hacker in a basement. That these people who are writing the first draft of history have already an agenda before they write it. What's that effect on democracy?
You know, I'm not a journalist major. And I can barely type, but no, just serious. Number two pencils. But the reality is there is place for total bias in the most objective paper. It's called the editorials.
Sure.
And editorials, you know, Eric Zorn can say, you know, I like stinking poops. And here's my reason for stinking poops, even though all of Chicago wants a stinking poop.
Sure, sure.
Whatever
it is. I understand.
An editorial is
but we're talking.
Opinion.
I'm not talking about editorial.
Right.
I'm
but
talking
what's
about
what's happened now in the last 50
right.
years is that papers now, the Gray Lady is not the Gray Lady. The Gray Lady is a Democratic liberal organ, you know, and the Washington Post is da-da, and it's happened. That, and the Tribune, when I was in high school, was, you know, so far to the right.
Yeah.
It was so conservative.
Colonel McCormick,
and
right.
certainly it's moved ages and down that spectrum immensely. But yes, the news outlets now. As Obama said at one time, I thought an absolute candor, well, I don't watch Fox News because I can't stand feeling that bad. Or who are they talking about? Yeah. They're talking about me? I can't even recognize what they're talking about, and it's me. And yet, if you watch this, if you watch, what's her name? Maddow on TV, this is a totally Democratic progressive, FDR progressive agenda, Keynesian analysis of.
I wonder when. In the lens that we're talking about tonight,
yeah.
as we start to wrap up here, the lens is, what are the threats? Tyranny is a threat, and that's what Timothy Snyder does in his
right.
book. Is he leads 20 things that are a threat to democracy.
Right, that's right.
One of the questions I have is, if it's not just about an uninformed electorate, how important is it that that you mentioned right at the top, we talked about facts and making sure that that's an objective.
And it's
you
also
talked
about
Senator Moynihan.
This is a crisis of both.
How do you make sure right. that is not hijacked?
And I don't know the answer. I'm just a critic. Yeah. But I do know that the problem is double wham. A, the electorate is not sufficiently informed, doesn't know how to make distinctions. B, the press itself has become so biased. Here's
the people who are making the news.
Here's
the source.
Statistic.
Right.
In 1976, only 28% had confidence in the media. Only 28%. As of this year, and this is University of Chicago NORC survey, right down the block here, 8%.
That's
what
terrible.
Does that
That's
say?
Terrible.
What does that
okay,
say?
Okay, so let me ask this then, as we talk about the threats to democracy, we're only talking about one part. We're talking about media. The other part that seems to always rear its head is the fact that they're special interest.
Yeah.
Special interest, money plays a big role in democracy. We see how it plays out in politics and how it changes laws or protects laws, or as we just talked about with the school shootings and how many we've had just in this year. That always harkens back to a strong lobby.
Right.
So how does that play a part in dismantling democracy? And how does democracy overcome special interests that may or may not have been there when it was deceived?
Yeah, well, you know, the bottom line is money talks. Money buys enough time to get an agenda out. Money buys the correct spokesman. Money buys the correct craftsman, the right wordsmiths to put this out. And that is the dilemma. Who are we listening? In fact, I would suggest that we have a surfeit of news. Having said that, in the 19th century, in Chicago alone, I think there were 22 papers, and I think there were 8 dailies when Lincoln was made president, because we were a typographical society. That was the main form of communication.
Yeah.
Every time Lincoln spoke, if it was extemporaneous, he ran inside and wrote it down and gave it to a press, say, please print this. This is what really meant to say. Words were critical. I think we've lost the essential beauty, structure, and value of carefully chosen words. We have a surfeit of information, and I think that bombardment of information leads a lot of us to just turn it off. NPR, we know if you turn on NPR, NPR is supposed to be unbiased. You've got to be kidding. Of course it isn't unbiased.
Right.
Maybe an unbiased liberal perspective, but it certainly has a perspective. And so I think one of the real dilemmas is this knowledge explosion that we have hasn't necessarily produced clarity, but further confusion.
Last point is about isolationism.
Yeah.
And how democracy is a global phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's going to be different types of government, but democracy has obviously spread around the world. We fought for it in different eight generations in this country. When we talk about isolationism when it comes to our country, or saying this is America first or otherwise, how does that affect the ecosystem that is democracy on this planet?
Well, I think that you got to remember, I don't think we're ever going to have a fascistic takeover of this nation. No one person is going to come in there and say, the Führer Prinzip, I'm taking over, I'm the ruler. But we may have, as I said, this notion of authoritarian democracy that people elect the bully in. Because, and I think when that happens is because the loss of national identity, financial crisis, spiritual intellectual crisis, fear of others, outsiders, eradication of objective standards of truth, that's when it could happen. And I think the real danger is assuming this is like pledge week at WBZ. I'm not going to pledge today because somebody else will and it'll be okay.
Yeah.
No, if you want a democracy, it means you have to participate just like everyone else has to do it.
Participation. That's it. Al Jeanney, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at the Loyola University of Chicago. He joins us once a month to take on the big ticket items. He'll be back next month. Professor, good to see you.
Good to see you.